Episode 12, The Vampire's Lair. Dr. Van Helsing has gathered a small band of individuals dedicated to finding and destroying Count Dracula. They are Mina Harker, Jonathan Harker, Dr. John Seward, Sir Arthur Holmwood, and Mr. Quincy Morris. He has shared with them the strengths and weaknesses of the Nosferatu, the undead. The moment has come to begin the hunt. Our story continues at the doors of Carfax, the vampire's lair.
The five of us, Van Helsing, Dr. Seward, Holmwood, Quincy Morris, and myself, made our way over the stone wall. Storm clouds were threatening as we moved silently over the grounds. When we reached the great doors of Carfax, Van Helsing turned and spoke.
My friends, we are going into a terrible danger, and we need arms of many kinds. Our enemy is not merely spiritual. Remember that he has the strength of 20 men, and we must guard ourselves from his touch. For each of you, I have these. Here, the crucifix. Keep it near your heart. And put these flowers of garlic around your neck. For the more common enemy, the revolver and the knife. And here, these so small electric lamps which you can fasten to your breast. And for all, and above all at the last, this, a small portion of the sacred wafer. Friend John, where are the skeleton keys?
I have them here.
Then use them.
Dr. Seward tried one or two skeleton keys, his mechanical dexterity as a surgeon standing him in good stead. Presently, he got one to suit, and after a little play back and forth, the bolt yielded, and with a rusty clang, shot back. We pressed on the door. The rusty hinges creaked, and it slowly opened. The professor was the first to move forward and stepped into the open door. We all followed, and Quincy Morris spoke.
I hate rats. I bet this place is filthy with rats.
Don't worry about that, old man. I've a remedy should the need arise.
Arthur, Quincy, be still. This is not a schoolboy's outing. We are in the devil's own castle.
Indeed, we were. The whole place was thick with dust. The floor was seemingly inches deep, except where there were recent footsteps, in which, on holding down my lamp, I could see marks of hobnails where the dust was caked. In the corners were masses of spiders' webs, whereon the dust had gathered till they looked like old tattered rags as the weight had torn them partly down. After a moment, Van Helsing turned to me and said,
"You know this place, Jonathan. Which is the way to the chapel?"
I believe there, through that arched door.
Yes. This is the spot.
With a little trouble, we forced back the heavy oaken door. The place was small and close, and the long disuse had made the air stagnant and foul. There was an earthy smell, as of some dry miasma, which came through the fouler air. The odor itself seemed to carry all the ills of mortality, and with the pungent, acrid smell of blood. Every breath exhaled by that monster seemed to have clung to the place and intensified its loathsomeness.
The first thing is to see how many of the boxes are left. We must then examine every hole and corner and cranny and see if we cannot get some clue as to what has become of the rest.
I count 29, Professor.
But weren't there 50 boxes delivered?
Yes, 50 in all.
Are the others hidden?
No, not here. He has moved them to other locations. In this way, he may move with greater freedom. and, as all villains, he prefers to keep numerous holes in which to crawl should he be in any way threatened.
How will we find the other boxes?
They are not spirits. They are large and heavy, and by necessity need be transported by strong men. He has not the Slovaks here. These movements may be traced. A bit of detective work, I think, for young Harker.
There! Do you see it?
Where?
What?
I thought I saw a face.
There, in the shadows.
A trick of light, perhaps. I had followed Arthur's glance, and for an instant my heart stood still. Somewhere, looking out from the shadow, I seemed to see the highlights of the Count's evil face. The edge of the nose, the red eyes, the red lips. But it was only for a moment.
Oh, Lord, look at this, will you?
We all followed Quincy's movements with our eyes, and we saw a whole mass of phosphorescence, which twinkled like stars. We all instinctively drew back. The whole place was becoming alive with rats. For a moment or two, we stood appalled, all save Arthur, who rushed over and swung open the great iron-bound oaken door. Then, taking a little silver whistle from his pocket, he blew a low, shrill call. It was answered by the yelping of dogs, and after about a minute, three terriers came dashing round the corner of the house. But even in that minute, the number of rats had vastly increased. They seemed to swarm all over the place all at once, till the lamplight shining on their moving dark bodies and glittering baleful eyes made the place look like a bank of earth set with fireflies. The dogs dashed on, but at the threshold suddenly stopped. This time, there were thousands of rats at our feet. Arthur lifted up one of the dogs and, carrying him in, placed him on the floor. The instant his feet touched the ground, he seemed to recover his courage and rushed at his natural enemies. They fled before him so fast that, before he had shaken the life out of a score, the other dogs had but small prey. The whole mass of vermin had vanished. And with their going, it seemed as if some evil presence had departed, and we all seemed to find our spirits rise.
Are we to look for the Count?
He won't be here. Not at this hour. This is when he feeds. This house is empty, I assure you.
Mr. Harker is correct. Our night has been eminently successful. No harm has come to us, and yet we have ascertained how many boxes are missing. And now, let us go home. The dawn is close at hand, and we have reason to be content with our first night's work.
The day after our visit to Carfax, I was in my study attending the managerial drudgeries of directing a medical facility when Van Helsing appeared at the door.
Do I interrupt?
Not at all. Come in. My work is finished. I am free to take you to Renfield, as you wished.
It is needless. I have seen him.
And?
I fear that he does not appraise me at much. Our interview was short. When I entered his room, he was sitting on a stool in the center with his elbows on his knees.
Daisy, Daisy. Humdy, humdy, hum. I'm half crazy. Dum-da-dee-dum-dee-dum. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford
it. So, you sing the ditty, yes?
But you'll look sweet. Dum-dee-dum-dee-dum.
Mr. Renfield?
Bicycle built for two.
Do you not know me?
I know you well enough. You are the old fool Van Helsing. I wish you would take yourself and your idiotic brain theory somewhere else. Damn all thick-headed Dutchmen.
Renfield called you a thick-headed Dutchman.
Idiotic brain theories. Have you ever heard of such foolishness?
Well, perhaps the man is showing some lucidity.
You would do well to not tease your elders, young man.
My apologies, Professor. So, he would not speak.
He would not converse. But he did mention Miss Mina, and it troubles me deeply.
What did he say?
Only that he has done what he could for her. That we have been warned and have refused his assistance. After this, he fell silent.
Mina Harker's Journal.
I feel strangely sad and low-spirited today. I suppose it is the reaction from the terrible excitement. I can't quite remember how I fell asleep last night. I remember hearing the sudden barking of the dogs and a lot of queer sounds, like praying on a very tumultuous scale from Mr. Renfield's room, which is somewhere under this. And then there was silence over everything. Silence so profound that it startled me. And I got up and looked out of the window. Not a thing seemed to be stirring, so that a thin streak of white mist that crept with almost imperceptible slowness across the grass towards the house seemed to have a sentience and a vitality of its own. The mist was spreading and was now close up to the house, so that I could see it laying thick against the wall, as though it was stealing up to the windows. I must have gone to bed, for I had the strangest dream. I thought I was asleep and waiting for Jonathan to come back. The gaslight, which I had left lit for Jonathan, came only like a tiny red spark through the fog, which had grown thicker and poured into the room. It occurred to me that I had shut the window before I had come to bed. I would have got up to make certain on the point, but some leaden lethargy seemed to chain my limbs and even my will. I lay still and endured. That was all. I closed my eyes, but could see through my eyelids. The mist grew thicker and thicker, and I could see now how it came in, for I could see it like smoke, or with the white energy of boiling water pouring in, not through the window, but through the joinings of the door. It got thicker and thicker, till it seemed as if it became concentrated into a sort of pillar of a cloud in the room, through the top of which I could see the light of the gas shining like a pair of red eyes. Things began to whirl through my brain, just as the cloudy column was now whirling in the room. The last conscious effort which imagination made was to show me a livid white face bending over me out of the mist.
As Van Helsing had directed, I undertook the detective work of finding the location, or locations, of the missing 21 boxes of earth. It did not prove a difficult task, for as the professor had pointed out, there are records of such matters. After a few inquiries, I was led to the home of a Mr. Sam Bloxham, a mover by trade.
All right, no need to bloody your knuckles. Well now, you're an handsome young one, ain't you, though?
Mrs. Bloxham.
It could be. What's your business?
My name is Jonathan Harker.
That's your name. What's your business?
I'm looking for Sam Bloxham, the mover. I'm interested in the recent movement of some large crates taken from Carfax Abbey. I was hoping that your husband could help.
Well, look here, Governor. You may find Sam soon, or you mayn't, but anyhow, he ain't likely to be in a way to tell you much. Sam is a rare one when he starts in drinking. And just now, he's up on a tear. You wait here. I'll see if I can't find the work order on it. Crates, you say?
Yes, crates. Large wooden boxes. There should have been 21 in all.
All right, all right. right. Just a moment, Governor. It's your lucky day, then, isn't it? Here we are, 21 Crites. There were 6 in one cartload, which he took from Carfax and left at 197 Chickson Street, Mile End, Newtown. The 6 all to 23 Jamaica Line, Bermondsey. 9 boxes were delivered to Piccadilly, number 347. That's it, then.
Why, yes, thank you. You've been most helpful, and thank your husband for me, please. Now we knew the location of the boxes. If then the Count meant to scatter these ghastly refuges of his over London, these 3 places were chosen as the first of delivery, so that later he might distribute more fully.
Dr. Seward's Diary, 1 October.
I am puzzled afresh about Renfield. His moods change so rapidly that I find it difficult to keep in touch of them. And, as they always mean something more than his own well-being, they form a more than interesting study. This morning, when I went to see him after his repulse of Van Helsing, his manner was that of a man commanding destiny. He did not really care for any of the things of mere earth. He was in the clouds and looked down on all the weaknesses and wants of us poor mortals. I thought I would improve the occasion and learn something. And how go the flies these times?
The fly, my dear sir, has one striking feature. Its wings are typical of the aerial powers of the psychic faculties. The ancients did well when they typified the soul as a butterfly.
Oh. It is a soul you're after now, is it?
Oh, no, no. I want no souls. Life is all I want. I am pretty indifferent about it at present. Life is all right. I have all I want. You must get a new patient, Doctor, if you wish to study zoophagy.
Then you command life. You are a god, I suppose.
Oh, no. Far be it from me to arrogate to myself the attributes of the deity. I am not even concerned in his especially spiritual doings. If I may state my intellectual position, I am, so far as concerns things purely terrestrial, somewhat in the position which Enoch occupied spiritually.
And why do you identify yourself with Enoch?
Because he walked with God.
So, you don't care about life, and you don't want souls. Why not?
I don't want any souls. Indeed, indeed, I don't. I couldn't use them if I had them. They would be no manner of use to me. I couldn't eat them or drink. And, Doctor, as to life, what is it, after all, when you've got all you require? And you know that you will never want. That is all. I have friends, good friends, like you, Dr. Seward. I know that I shall never lack the means of life.
Through the cloudiness of his insanity, he saw some antagonism in me. For he at once fell back on the last refuge of dogged silence. After a short time, I saw that for the present it was useless to speak to him. He was sulky, and so I came away. Later in the day, he sent for me. Ordinarily, I would not have come without special reason, but just at present I am so interested in him that I would gladly make an effort. Besides, I am glad to have anything to help to pass the time. Harker is out following up clues, and so are Arthur and Quincy. Van Helsing sits in my study poring over the record prepared by the Harkers. He seems to think that by accurate knowledge of all details, he will light upon some clue. He does not wish to be disturbed in the work without cause. And in fact, Renfield might not speak so freely before a third person as when he and I were alone. I found him sitting out in the middle of the floor on his stool, a pose which is generally indicative of some mental energy on his part. When I came in, he said at once, as though the question had been waiting on his lips,
"What about souls?"
What about them yourself? He did not reply for a moment, but looked all round him and up and down, as though he expected to find some inspiration for an answer.
"I don't want any souls."
"You like life, and you want life?"
"Oh, yes, but that is all right. You needn't worry about that."
"But how is one to get the life without getting the soul also?"
"Hmm?"
"A nice time you'll have sometime when you're flying out there with the souls of thousands of flies and spiders and birds and cats buzzing and twittering all around you. You've got their lives, you know, and you must put up with their souls."
"Hmm."
Something seemed to affect his imagination, for he put his fingers to his ears and shut his eyes, screwing them up tightly, just as a small boy does when his face is being soaped. There was something pathetic in it that touched me. It also gave me a lesson, for it seemed that before me was a child, only a child, though the features were worn and the stubble on the jaws was white. It was evident that he was undergoing some process of mental disturbance, and knowing how his past moods had interpreted things seemingly foreign to himself, I thought I would enter into his mind as well as I could and go with him. The first step was to restore confidence. So I asked him, speaking pretty loud so that he would hear me through his closed ears, "Would you like some sugar to get your flies round again?"
"Not much. Flies are poor things after all. But I don't want their souls buzzing around me all the same."
"Or spiders?"
"Blow spiders. What's the use of spiders? Isn't anything in them to eat or..."
He stopped suddenly, as though reminded of a forbidden topic. So, I thought to myself, this is the second time he has suddenly stopped at the word drink. What does it mean? Renfield seemed himself aware of having made a lapse, for he hurried on as though to distract my attention from it.
"I don't take any stock at all in such matters. Rats and mice, and such small deer, as Shakespeare has it, chicken feed of the larder they might be called. I'm past all that sort of nonsense. You might as well ask a man to eat molecules with a pair of chopsticks as to try to interest me about the lesser carnivora, when I know of what is before me."
"I see. You want big things that you can make your teeth meet in. How would you like to breakfast on an elephant?"
"What ridiculous nonsense you are talking."
"I wonder what an elephant's soul is like."
"I don't want an elephant's soul or any soul at all. To hell with you and your souls. Why do you plague me about souls? Haven't I got enough to worry and pain and distract me already without thinking of souls?"
"Calm yourself, Mr. Renfield."
"Forgive me, Doctor. I forgot myself. I am so worried in my mind that I am apt to be irritable. If you only knew the problem I have to face, and that I am working out, you would pity and tolerate and pardon me. Dr. Seward, you have been very considerate towards me. Believe me that I am very, very grateful to you."
I thought it well to leave him in this mood, and so I came away. There is certainly something to ponder over in this man's state. Several points seem to be constant with the man. They would tell a tale if one could only get them in the proper order. Here they are. Will not mention drinking. Fears the thought of being burdened with the soul of anything. Has no dread of wanting life in the future. despises the meaner forms of life altogether, though he dreads being haunted by their souls. Logically, all these things point one way. He has assurance of some kind that he will acquire some higher life. He dreads the consequence, the burden of a soul. Then it is a human life he looks to. And the assurance? Merciful God! The Count has been to him, and there is some new scheme of terror afoot. I went after my round to Van Helsing and told him of my suspicion. He grew very grave and, after thinking the matter over for a while, asked me to take him to Renfield. I did so. As we came to the door, we heard the lunatic within singing gaily, as he used to do in the time which now seems so long ago. When we entered, we saw with amazement that he had spread out his sugar as of old. The flies, lethargic with the autumn, were beginning to buzz into the room. We tried to make him talk of the subject of our previous conversation, but he would not attend. He went on with his singing, just as though we had not been present. He had got a scrap of paper and was folding it into a notebook. We had to come away as ignorant as we went in. This is a curious case indeed.
October 2, morning. Later. Before retiring, we all met again. Arthur Homewood, Quincy Morris, Jonathan Harker, Mina Harker, Van Helsing, and myself. We seemed at last to be on the track, and our work of tomorrow may be the beginning of the end. I wonder if Renfield's quiet has anything to do with this. His moods have so followed the doings of the Count that the coming destruction of the monster may be carried to him in some subtle way. If we could only get some hint as to what passed in his mind between the time of my argument with him today and his resumption of fly-catching, it might afford us a valuable clue. He is now seeming quiet for a spell. The attendant has just come to tell me that Renfield had somehow met with some accident. He had heard him yell, and when he went to him, found him lying on his face on the floor, all covered with blood.